And good morning. It is Wednesday, February 15, 2017. Here is your KDNK local newscast, live from the heart of Carbondale's Creative District. The suspect of Monday's bomb threat on the Colorado Mountain College campus in Leadville has been identified as 32-year-old Adam Slattery from Leadville. He was charged with false reporting, resisting arrest, menacing, criminal extortion, and harassment. According to a CMC press conference Tuesday, Slattery was a student at CMC last fall but is not currently enrolled. Lawmakers serving on the Senate Judiciary Committee will hear a measure to repeal Colorado's death penalty today. Ben Berkland has more from the state capitol.
Democrats have tried three times in the last decade to repeal the death penalty. Senate Minority Leader Lucia Guzman is the main sponsor of this year's measure, and even if it won't pass the Republican-controlled Senate, she says she wants to at least have the discussion. The proposal would impact cases for crimes committed after July 2017. Advocates say the death penalty is unfairly applied, ineffective, ethically wrong, and inconsistent. The issue largely falls along party lines, with a few exceptions. Last year, one Republican joined with Democrats to defeat a bill that would have made it easier to impose the death penalty by not requiring a jury's unanimous consent. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
The U.S. Senate is expected to hear a measure any day now that would repeal the Bureau of Land Management's plans to limit the waste of natural gas on public lands, Eric Kaladis reports.
According to a new survey conducted by AGC Research, nearly 7 in 10 members of both major parties support the Bureau of Land Management's protections. Jessica Goad with Conservation Colorado says the rules are a cost-effective way to prevent the loss of nearly $330 million worth of gas each year.
Oil and natural gas that is on public lands belongs to all of us as taxpayers. And when that natural gas is vented or flared into the atmosphere, that is essentially money, taxpayer money, going up into flames.
Royalties paid by companies tapping publicly owned mineral assets are split between states and the federal government. Oil and gas producers worked with conservation groups to develop a plan adopted in Colorado in 2014 to limit methane waste, the primary component of natural gas, but say federal rules would add another layer of red tape and slow down access to permits. Goad disagrees and says companies are in the clear if a state's regulations meet or exceed federal protections. She notes federal rules are important because methane pollution doesn't stay inside state lines, and points to areas of southwestern Colorado where she says a methane hotspot generated by oil and gas production in Utah and New Mexico is so big it can be seen from space. Goad adds Colorado Senators Cory Gardner and Michael Bennett will be critical votes on this issue.
And in a lot of ways, I think this is the first test for both of them to see whether they're going to vote on behalf of Coloradans and our public health and our way of doing things, our collaborative way of doing things, or whether they're going to vote with Washington, D.C. ideology.
The U.S. House of Representatives invoked the rarely used Congressional Review Act to reverse actions taken by the BLM in the final days of the Obama administration. If the Senate follows suit, the agency would be prohibited from passing similar protections in the future. This is Eric Galatis reporting for KDNK.
Tonight's Naturalist Night features Dr. George Wittemeyer, who will present energy development impacts on wildlife based on a recent mule deer study. Here he explains results and more to KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh.
It sounds like from the results of the study so far that oil and gas extraction, at least in the Piance Basin here in western Colorado, has no impact or very little impact on reproduction rates and survival.
Right. And actually, Colorado Parks and Wildlife led to this deeper digging into what's going on in this region. And they have done really detailed following of deer and assessments of their demographic rates. And so this entails doing counts every year and looking at reproductive rates of adults and fat reserves on deer during the beginning of winter and the end of winter. And the analysis of those data essentially shows that there's really no difference in survivorship between areas in the Piance that are experiencing high development versus those experiencing low development. There's no difference in adult survivorship or fawn survivorship. There's no difference in fat reserves, body condition scores, and pregnancy rates. All of those are essentially identical between these areas. And at the same time, the radio tracking data shows major behavioral difference between those areas. And so it looks like the behavioral modifications that deer are conducting either are buffering them from any demographic impacts of the changes to the habitat or don't have a major effect on their fitness. We were studying these impacts as development declined to essentially nothing. And so we were looking at a relaxation of habitat that was compromised by human activity. Essentially, that human activity reduced, and therefore the amount of habitat that was being impacted by human activity reduced during our study. And so in some ways, we might have been recording the relaxation and the response to that relaxation. And so what we were seeing is the deer population in the Piceance has increased over our study period as the development has declined. You know, the money came through and the research program started at the peak phase of development in the Piceance, and then in a process that none of us could foresee, the economic bottom dropped out of the natural gas production, and just by happenstance, we sort of got the unfortunate situation of studying the decline of development on the Piceance. So what that means for this period of ramp-up that might be coming again is really hard to say. But what we do know is if we create enough cover on the landscape, if we develop in a planned manner and are able to protect some of the critical cover and critical foraging grounds for the deer, they will certainly persist on the landscape.
The CPW is planning on conducting a predator study on the Rhone Plateau and a little bit north of Rifle to determine whether mountain lion and bear are having an impact on fawn survival. These studies will go on for 2 years in May and June. They're going to be taking mountain lion and bear and killing a certain amount just to see if that has an impact on fawn survival rates. What are your thoughts about that study?
You know, there's been quite a bit of work done on predator removals across the West. Generally, what we find is that it looks like the mortality caused by predators is compensatory rather than additive. And so what that means is that predators are killing a certain amount of the prey, in this case mule deer, and those individuals that they're taking, if they weren't killed by predators, they probably wouldn't survive. They would have mortality from a different source. And so we say the predation is compensating for another source of mortality. So overall, it doesn't change survival much, that predation. We don't see a lot of evidence of predation being additive, meaning that it increases mortality rates, decreases survivorship of deer. And that's been shown across a number of different systems. Interestingly, we find with neonates in general that the primary mortality source is predators. This has been shown in the Piceance, and it's been shown in other systems as well. The question is, if you remove that pressure of the predators, will it have any effect on the deer population? From the studies that I'm familiar with and that I've seen, I would suspect that it won't have an effect on the deer population. I think the CPW study on predation in the Piceance, what they might show is that they can increase neonate survivorship, at least for the first month or so of life. And the question is, does that have any ramifications for the deer population itself? And I'm not sure that's going to be addressed in the study or not.
Dr. George Wittemeyer talks tonight at 5:30 at the 3rd Street Center. 67,000 Coloradans live with Alzheimer's disease, and that number is expected to rise 37% by 2025. Tonight, Colorado Public Television hosts an event that gives caregivers and others across the state a chance to weigh in on the disease. KDNK's Amy Haddon Marsh and Amelia Schaefer, Vice President of Programs for the Alzheimer's Association of Colorado, recently discussed the disease. Here they talk about the stress it causes caregivers.
In the Colorado Public Television program tonight, viewers will be taking a look at three couples. One of each couple is living with Alzheimer's, and the other one is the caregiver, the primary caregiver. And I'm wondering, how is Alzheimer's caregiving different than, say, caregiving for someone whose illness has nothing to do with the brain?
It really is through the efforts of caregivers that we see the quality of life and quality of care for the individual with Alzheimer's either get better or get worse. And we know that caregivers of individuals with Alzheimer's have the number one caregiver burnout rate. We know they have the number one caregiver stress rate, which unfortunately means they also have the number one caregiver mortality rate, meaning that the stress and strain is so great that the caregiver ends up dying before the individual with the disease. If you look at the length of this disease, I've worked with families who've cared for someone up to 20 years. That is a very long time to have another individual who you are caring for completely, whether it be in your home or in their home, or eventually for many people, it's looking for residential care outside the home. And then you are talking about a financial toll and financial strain on families that many people don't talk about. It's a very taboo subject to talk about, but we know that senior care is extremely expensive, and Medicare does not pay for it, and in many cases, people aren't qualifying for Medicaid. So what that means is it's coming out of my pocket, your pocket, it's coming out of whoever is in this individual's life. So we see families pulling together to pay $6,000 to $10,000 on average per month to pay for residential care. And that financial strain is also, I think, a great strain on caregivers as well. And also, I think it's that idea that this person is changing. They are no longer the person that someone knows and loves. And sometimes the changes are very hard to accept, especially when it relates to a person's relationship. When your mother forgets who you are, when your father forgets who you are, it's very painful to go through a process like that and to continue being 100% committed as a caregiver.
A little self-disclosure, I have not yet seen the film that will air tonight on Colorado Public Television, but I have watched the trailer for it and read some about it. And what struck me was that somebody who was a caregiver talked about going through a photo book, you know, a scrapbook, and realizing that they were really the only one that was going through that book and having those memories, because the person with Alzheimer's was slowly but surely forgetting the memories that were associated with those photographs. And to me, that was really striking.
Yeah, it's a very heartbreaking part of this disease, that those shared memories are really becoming much more one-sided, because the individual with the disease is regressing back in time. They're forgetting things that happened recently. They're really going back to a time when they were younger, and they may eventually forget their family. They may forget that they ever moved out of their home in which they were born. They may really focus on looking for their own mom or dad and siblings, and that becomes their world, as opposed to the world that we've all built around an individual. So it really can be heartbreaking. And I think one of the big things I tell families is to know that you are not going through this alone, to know that you are not the only one facing this, and to understand how others have coped and some of their strategies is really one of the best things you can do for yourself, because it can be a very isolating and lonely disease for caregivers. So that's why we find it so important for them to reach out, whether it be through an online chat room or a support group in their neighborhood or an online education class or calling someone on our 24-hour helpline, to really understand that they are not alone in going through this and that they don't have to have all the answers, that there are people here who want to help them and people here who are here to help them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That is very important for people, because, again, it can be extremely isolating.
More information about tonight's Colorado Public Television event is at cpt12.org/Alzheimer's.